Good morning. It's wonderful to see all of you here. Today is March 10th, and this is the Education Subcommittee for the Full Ways and Means Committee. It is our tradition. We're going to talk about how much time people have to speak this morning, but it is our tradition to make sure that anyone that is 100 miles away definitely gets to be heard, and we're checking here to see if
we have some.
Yes, okay, we have some that have come a full 100 miles, and so
why don't you go ahead and start with who you want, and we'll make sure those get on, Madam Chair.
Okay.
You have to open the public hearing on the two.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5016, House Bill 5017, and I'm going to have Mr. Wilson explain our very sophisticated, high technical system of helping you monitor how long you've been talking.
Madam Chair, members, this is the traditional stoplight. We'll time it at 3 minutes. At when you have a minute left, it goes to yellow. And when you have 30 seconds left, it starts to blink at you. And then we will cut you off right around 3 minutes. Given the amount of time we have, I think six full sheets, if not more. Not sure what's out there still, so I'd be doubtful that we'll get through everything today.
Yeah, I was going to say, how many lines are on a sheet?
10 on a sheet.
And then some places have three names. So.
And I would encourage folks, excuse me, Madam Chair, if you are going to be here tomorrow, if you're a person that spends a lot of time in this building, maybe first you should get some professional help. No, I'm sorry. But anyways, it would be very beneficial if you could come back tomorrow and let us know. It'd be very helpful.
Yes. But to start us out this morning, I've had a special request, and these are two people that have been in education a long time, so their 3 minutes are going to be the example for everybody else, right? Put a little pressure on them. Hannah Vanderlein and Craig Hawkins. And then after those two...
we'll skip between bills.
Okay, after those two, we'll have Becky Moore and Judy Newman, and then Lori Kellogg. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Who's going to start that clock? So
here we go. Okay. Good morning, co-chairs Compton Monroe and members of the committee. My name is Hannah Vandering. For the record, I'm an elementary physical education teacher and president of the Oregon Education Association. I'm here representing OEA's 42,000 members to ask that the 2015 legislature invest in our students and fund public education with an eye towards ensuring that all students have the school that he or she deserves. Over the next 2 days, you're going to hear from educators, parents, board members, and others about the impact that years of cuts have had on the students that we work with. You'll hear, although our economy has seemed to recover, our schools are nowhere close to restoring the cuts that have been made over the last few years. Our members hope you'll find a way to go beyond the crisis funding level and instead build a quality learning environment so that our students can succeed in our schools. We've seen the headlines. Oregon has some dubious distinctions of having the second largest class size, one of the shortest school years in the nation, and a low graduation rate for our students. We can successfully address these issues, but not if we allow 50 students to be in a high school science class or allow cut days and programs to balance the budget. We must fund programs that keep our students in school and provide extra support to those learners that are struggling. Our vision like yours includes full-day kindergarten for all of our first-year students. We also believe that the budget for the Department of Education must include sufficient resources to meet the needs of our struggling students, struggles that are barriers to learning for those. The co-chair's framework budget, unfortunately, does not meet these objectives. To achieve the objectives in 2015-17, the state school fund must be at least $7.5 billion. While we understand the key to a no-cuts budget is sufficient state resources, we also understand that the legislature has the ability to make choices about how they deploy existing resources. Before we create new programs or fund targeted initiatives, we believe it's essential that we fund the state school fund. We hope you've reviewed this year's coalition funding budget. It's meant to give you a grasp of what funding at certain levels will really mean for our schools. You'll see individual district posters coming out to help you understand exactly where your district will be. OEA and our members also encouraged this committee to adopt ODE's policy option package 148. This will fund House Bill 2545 and House Bill 2846. These nutrition bills are aimed at feeding our students who need it. Research demonstrates that students who are adequately fed are better able to learn. More than 30,000 students in Oregon need nutritious-based meals to maintain their long-term health and optimize their ability to be successful in our classrooms. It's time to address the issue of poverty that is undermining our students' ability to focus and achieve. The current demands are being made that 100% of our students succeed academically.
Yeah,
we must follow this commitment.
I need to ask you to come to your last sentence.
I'm right there, followed with the commitment of support. We can no longer demand outcomes without providing the inputs that are necessary to ensure that our students succeed. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for your work in providing the greatest resources to our public schools.
Thank you, Hannah. Craig, good morning.
Good morning, co-chairs Comp and Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, Craig Hawkins, executive director of COSA. I've provided you with some of the slides from a PowerPoint that superintendents and others have been using as we talk about the state school fund for the next biennium in our communities and with our school communities around the state. The first couple of slides you've seen before, they show the share of the education budget over the last dozen years compared to the rest of the state budget. You've seen that information. But the third slide, I think, is really important. The dozen years of this declining investment have resulted in what we call Oregon's education fundamentals gap. Hannah mentioned some of these things. We have about 1 year less than the national average in instructional time in Oregon. We have the second highest class sizes in the nation, and that is six more students per teacher than the national average. We have a funding record here that is not where it used to be. And an example of that is today Oregon spends about 88% of the national average per student on K-12. In 1997-98, less than 20 years ago, that was 104%. So the decline compared to the rest of the nation is also there. I provided this slide about the smarter balance gap just to give you a sense, because it's a topic of interest these days, and to give you a sense that Oregon, along with a couple of other states, has the least amount of instructional time through grade 11 for students preparing for smarter balanced, and in fact, almost a year less of instruction than the national average for other students who are also taking smarter balanced. We spent time this fall and winter meeting with districts really carefully so that we were sure that we would give you very accurate information about impacts of potential state school fund levels on school districts, what it would mean to students in those districts. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time on the co-chair's $7.235 billion level today.
And you do have 55 seconds.
Thank you. So what that level means is significantly reduced funding per student on an average of negative $87 a student compared current year compared to next year based on ODE estimates. And that's going to result in teacher and staff layoffs, fewer school days, higher class sizes, and so much more. And honestly, what that means is full-day kindergarten is not funded in this budget. Instead, districts will be forced to choose between implementing full-day K and or cutting programs, raising class sizes, et cetera, for kids in grades 1 through 12. I'll just point you to this sheet here that shows for about a dozen districts in Oregon what the negative per student impact would be at this at the co-chair's budget level, and you could pull out any dozen districts at random and have a similar sample. finally, I'll just say that $7.5 billion, as Hannah mentioned, means that districts, on average, around the state, will be able to implement full-day kindergarten and maintain current programs and class sizes. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your time and coming this morning. As stated, our next panel, and we have some parents and some beautiful children coming our way. It's Becky Moore and Judy Newman and then Lori Kellogg. And then on deck, yes, we'll have Cassandra Trant and Sarah Kyle and Brandy Zaffy.
And Megan.
Oh, and Megan Nguyen. And of course, Mom's going to introduce this beautiful young lady.
This is Lily Moore.
This is Lily Moore. Okay. Good morning, Lily.
Good morning, everyone. Good looking.
I like your purple.
Thank you. She likes your shirt, sweetie.
Good morning. I think I'll get us started off. My name is Lori Kellogg. I'm with Northwest Regional ESD, working in early intervention. And I'm going to speak today and giving an overview of early intervention, early childhood special education. Early intervention, early childhood special education is also known as EIECSE. It's special education for birth to five-year-old children who have developmental disabilities, delays, and sensory impairment. Some examples include Down syndrome, autism spectrum disorder, deafness, blindness, cerebral palsy, emotional disturbance, communication disorders, and general developmental delay. EIECSE services are mandated in federal and state law. They are entitlement services for eligible children and include procedural safeguards for children and their parents. These services have been mandated in Oregon since 1992. EIECSE provides family-friendly, seamless, efficient, and effective services to eligible children who are birthed to 5 years of age across the state. Examples of services provided include speech and language therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, parent coaching, specialized preschool instruction, behavior and social skills training, and evidence-based strategies for children with autism spectrum disorder. Services are individually determined based on each child's special needs and written in an individual family service plan. Services are provided in a variety of settings, such as the child's home, child care, community preschools, clinics, and other community programs. Parents and professionals are partners in all aspects of the program. Interventions are based on proven practices from research that demonstrate efficacy. Who provides services? The EIECSE program utilizes highly qualified professionals who have expertise with young children, and many of these specialists hold master's degrees in their respective fields. How is this program funded? The EIECSE funds are a combination of federal funds, state general funds, and the education grants and aid budget, and Medicaid fee-for-service reimbursements. Anyone who suspects a birth to five-year-old child has a delay or disability can refer to an EIECSE program within their county. Referrals come from the following sources: parents, child care providers, Head Start physicians, and DHS child welfare workers. EIECSE programs are prohibited from having wait lists for services because there are federal and state mandated services. Growth has been gradual and steady, averaging 2 to 3% each year for the past 4 years. The state is currently serving approximately 12,000 children and families. Funding has not kept pace with growth in ineligible children, so services have been reduced. There are outcomes that are on the back of the page about how these services have impacted the lives of children and families and improving their skills. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Ms. Newman.
Thank you. Co-chairs Comp and Monroe and members of the Ways and Means Education Committee. I'm Judy Newman. I'm the co-director of the Early Childhood Cares Program, which is an early intervention, early childhood special ed program in Lane County. And I wanted to share a couple of key issues, but I'm going to just share one because of the time today, and hopefully you'll read the two-page handout I passed around. But I want you to know, and that's about the early learning hubs and the way that early intervention, early childhood special education is coordinating with them and the impacts and benefits that we're having. So in all the ECSE programs and all the early learning hubs are involved, and very often they have leadership positions in this new early childhood system. One of the immediate ways that the work of the early learning hubs is impacting EIECSE programs is by increasing referrals for children under 3 years of age. The hubs have a shared metric with CCOs, as you know, to increase the rates of developmental screenings for children under three. So this is really fantastic. We are really happy about this. It means kids are found earlier and they get the help they need as soon as possible. So the programs that receive those referrals when a physician suspects a child of having a delay or identifies a delay are EIECSE programs. In my program, in the past 4 or 5 years, when I look at the percentage of children we serve under three, it has been about 22% to 24%. Those are kids birth to three. Now, this last December, when we did our census, that number jumped to 34%, which means that we're really finding more kids younger, which means this is really doing its job. And those increases really match the numbers. We've been looking a lot at the Trillium, which is our CCO. They are really increasing their developmental screening rates. They're only at about 50 or 60%. So what we're saying is that we're expecting more growth in identifying kids sooner. Now, EIECSE programs can't have wait lists because we're federally mandated entitlement programs, and we serve kids really quickly, within 45 days. Again, a wonderful thing for kids and families, but a big challenge for programs. We really need to be adequately funded to meet the need of these new kids coming in. So as Lori mentioned, over time, the services have decreased in terms of the amount of services we're able to provide kids. So we really are asking that you support the EIECSE funds. There's this increase in the House Bill 5016 to help mitigate some of these issues and really get these young Oregonians served as soon as possible. We're excited and really encouraged about these collaborations and the early learning system, and we thank you for your support. And if you have time to read the two-page handout, there are some other really good points made, but I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was perfect.
Nice job. I can talk faster.
The A-plus for the day. Becky.
Hi. Co-chair and committee members, thank you so much for having me today. My name is Becky Moore, and I'm here with my daughter, Lily Moore, from Central Oregon. And I wanted to speak with you today to tell you about how important these programs are to families. My daughter, Lily, is a very normal four-year-old in the respect that she loves Disney movies. She loves going to the park and playing with her friends and going to school. When Lily was about a year old, she lost so many things, though, because of Rett syndrome. So the ability to walk, talk, and use her hands almost overnight. And the amazing people that we have had the opportunity to work with came to us in our home and tried to bridge the gap for us. They brought education, they brought hugs and smiles and said, you know what, it's going to be okay. And yeah, life is different and we have a new normal, and they've been able to help show us how to function within that new normal and that it is okay and life is going to work, and here's some tricks, here's some things that you can be doing at home to make this work. And because of those services, we think that that's done amazing things for our daughter, and we want you to know how important that funding is. Had we had more of those services, we think that life could be even better. You know, there's these good people doing a lot of really wonderful things with not much to go on, and there's only so long that people can do more with less, if that makes sense. And so I strongly advocate for my daughter and for all of the youth in Oregon. Please support us all. Please show that you care about us and that you think our children are important as much as we do. And she's ready for a nap. So I really appreciate the time that you've given me today, and please consider increasing the funding so that we can do more with a little bit more.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, Becky, for traveling. Where do you live?
We live in Terrebonne, so over in Central Oregon.
She's mine.
Well, Representative Hoffman thinks that everybody over there is his constituent. So.
I claim them all, but Terrebonne is mine.
Yes. And so that you'll be there when Lily needs a nap. Okay.
Awesome.
Thank you so much. Yes. Okay, now we have Cassandra and Sarah and Brandy and Megan. And on tap, we're going to go with a panel of folks here. Sam Lee from, I believe, here from the school board, Heidi Sipe and Doug Gall will be the next three. We'll do it that way. You need another chair. Okay. We're getting another chair.
Okay.
Just go ahead and start. Thanks, Heidi.
Oh, looks like you're connected, Heidi. Go ahead and start. You're fine.
Co-Chair Kopp and Co-Chair Monroe and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Coyano. I reside in Cottage Grove, Oregon. My husband Derek and I have five children. Our youngest is Carly, who is with me today. And you may recognize her. She's the model from the 2013 Developmental Disabilities Awareness poster, which I'm sending some copies of a postcard around. Carly was born with trisomy 21, which means she has an extra 21st chromosome, also known as Down syndrome. After my husband and I heard of the diagnosis, we were initially shocked, but quickly recovered, knowing that we love this little girl no matter what. And we have the same hopes and dreams for Carly as we do for our other children. Carly is the bravest and most determined little girl that I know. She enjoys playing with her dolls and her kitchen and loves Elmo and the Wiggles. She especially enjoys playing with Bailey, her big sister, who's her BFF. Early intervention started for our family when Carly was 4 months old. It started with home visits and then eventually speech therapy. Mm. Now Carly is in community preschool, and she is in a preschool with typical peers. We have early childhood special education services at the school. She has speech therapy, augmentative communication, consultation, visits from her early intervention specialist, and we also have a special education assistant who periodically comes to the classroom to work with Carly to help in ways that the teacher maybe is too busy to help with. For example, she helps Carly with her iPad during circle time to make choices. I cannot begin to tell you how much early intervention and early childhood special education has meant to our family. We have always had high expectations for Carly, and more importantly, she has high expectations for herself. From the very first meeting with Vicki, our early intervention specialist, it was obvious that she too had high expectations for Carly. She never once told me, "Carly can't do that." Vicki was a huge source of inspiration and support for our family. She was a person who understood when others didn't. I will forever be grateful for her. When Carly started preschool, we knew that we wanted her in a community preschool with her typical peers. Early childhood special education has helped provide the supports that Carly needs to succeed in that setting. Not only is Carly successful in preschool, but she enjoys it immensely and she has many friends. She's also made a huge impression on her teachers. She is an important part of her school and an important part of her community, and we know that this success will follow through to kindergarten and beyond. Early intervention has provided our family and our daughter a framework of information, encouragement, and support that has helped ensure her success. I request that you increase funding for the vital services of early intervention and early childhood special education. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Oh, thanks, Sarah, and we'd just ask Carly, so if you'd go ahead and continue.
Co-Chairs Kopp and Monroe and members of the subcommittee, my name is Cassandra Trout from Springfield. I am here today because of my son, Ben, who was born with a very rare genetic disorder and intellectual disability. Ben is now 4, but our family began working with early interventionists when he was only 2 months old. Our service providers have worked with us each year to identify his needs, which have always been significant, and to ensure that our family had the tools and resources we needed to help him meet those needs. Ben's intervention team has been the foundation of our family's support system and has had a profound impact on his development. He finally learned to walk last year, and although he still can't speak to us, he's responding to his name, and he's interacting with us more each day. You know, we've all heard that the parent is the child's first and best teacher. Children learn so much by listening to us and watching us and interacting with us. But think, if you have a child who can't listen to you because he has hearing loss and isn't watching you because he's more interested in his hand than anything you have to say, and doesn't want to make eye contact with you, let alone interact with you, you can begin to feel lost. I lost a lot of hope. What do you do? Early intervention and early childhood special education helps families to rebuild their hope by giving them the tools they need to help their children succeed. Our specialists made a difference for Ben, not because of the short time they spent with him, but because of what they taught my husband and me. You know, in Oregon, of the children with the most significant needs, like Ben, less than 2% are actually receiving the service levels that are recommended by research and best practices in order to make the biggest impact on these families. Funding has not kept pace with the new children being identified for service levels, and because of that, service levels have decreased substantially. Our service levels decreased. Evidence shows that if we invest in these children now when they are young, we can save so much when they get into formal schooling. Oregon has invested in early intervention and early childhood special ed in order to change the lives of these children and families. So we need to actually invest enough to be able to provide the level of service proven to be effective in making those changes. I request that you increase funding for early intervention and early childhood special education. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify before you here today, and I'd also be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, and just appreciate all your courage.
Thanks.
Please continue.
Hi, good morning. My name is Brandy Zapp, and this is Tucker. And after that,
sorry.
No, I think it goes without saying that all of our children need
education. Let Tucker know there's no smoking in the Capitol.
Some of us just need more help than others. I bring you Tucker today because Tucker is autistic, and he's had an opportunity to take advantage of the early intervention programs. Before we got engaged with the intervention program, Tucker was very withdrawn, unaware of his surroundings, and struggled just with everyday life. We got involved with the early intervention program when he was about 3 years old, and we immediately saw a change in his behavior. Not only did he get help, but we as a family did too. We were offered classes, we had home visits, we had one-on-one instruction, and it was all of us who changed, not just Tucker. And what they did is they gave us the roadmap we needed in order to continue this journey. So why are we here today? It's because of the statistics. With Tucker being autistic, just 2 years ago, it was 1 in 88 children. Today it's 1 in 68. It's a 30% increase just in 2 years. Thank you, Tucker. So we see an increase in children that need the service and help. And what we ask today is that you consider increasing the funding for the early intervention programs so that we can help additional children that need these services. So I thank you for listening today and appreciate your time and your considerations.
And I thank you for bringing Tucker. And the microphones are real highly sensitive, so it doesn't have to be real close for you.
Sounds good. He might start talking too. Hi there. I'm Megan Nguyen. I brought my son Bennett with me here today.
Mama's going to talk a little bit. Bennett was born with Down syndrome on June 7th, 2010, a month before his due date. He had many complications when entering the world. He spent close to the first month of his life in the NICU, recovering from major abdominal surgery. Yeah, you can give me a hug, man. I know you're tired. Sorry. He was. He spent that first month basically just trying to grow and recover. And the first 3 months of his life were actually kind of a blur because we spent that time trying to get our 5-pound newborn to the magical 10-pound mark so that he could have his open heart surgery. In all the time that we were, the many days and hours and weeks that we were in the hospital, the countless specialists, neonatologists, nurses, everybody that we saw, can you take a guess for me how much information we were actually given on Down syndrome? The answer is zero. I know, pal. I know. Mama's talking, bud. I love you. I love you so much. Yeah, Violet's with Grandma. Okay, what generally happens when we visit the specialists and the developmental doctors is they test him, and we're told where he falls compared to a typical child, and sometimes that'll range from he might be doing something that a 6-month-old is doing all the way to a 3-year-old, and we're told that they would like him to start achieving A, B, and C, but not actually given the tools or taught how to get him there. Lucky for us, that all changed when we met Elsa Young, who was his early intervention teacher from the time he was 3 months old until he turned 3 and entered the preschool program. She came into our house and she. Can we sit down, pal?
No.
Yeah, let's sit down.
No.
She came into our house and she was really the first person to teach us about Bennett.
You can let him run.
Okay, you want to roam, man? You want to roam?
Yeah.
Okay, take a walk. You want to take a walk? Okay. But Elsa was the first person to teach us about Down syndrome, and she asked us important questions. She asked, the very first thing she asked was if he slept a lot. And children with Down syndrome generally do sleep quite a bit, and parents like that because, hey, you've got a sleepy newborn. But what she taught us was that when children are sleeping, they're not learning. And so that's very profound. We needed to make sure that he wasn't sleeping too much and that he was... Yes, buddy.
Goodbye.
Yeah, Violet's with Benoit. Anyhow, Elsa was this person that came into our life, and instead of talking at us, she worked with us. She would bring specialists into our home that had the same approach, and that was really helpful. We were really sad to say goodbye to Elsa when he did turn 3, but we've been equally impressed with the preschool program. He acts just like a typical kid most days. He walks into school, puts his backpack down, gets out his snack, because he likes snacks, and he participates in class. We've been so impressed with the program that when my daughter turned 3 in December, we actually enrolled her in the typical peer program, because she's going to be around him the rest of her life, and he's going to be around her, and we would like her to be... yeah, pal.
Goodbye.
Yeah, we're going to go see Violet. Anyhow, the main point I want to make is that it's very important. We'd like to increase funding. I grew up in an area where I had a lot of school pride. I entered college with 19 high school credits, and I want Bennett to have the same sense of pride that I did with his education. And I think the only way to do that is to increase funding so that he can have access to services that I think he deserves.
Well, thank you. Just a brief comment. First of all, the courage and faith that it takes all of you to work with the challenges you face every day is really incredible. Thank you for coming today. We hear a lot of negative things about things that we do here in Oregon, and watching you for beautiful mothers makes me very, very proud. So thank you, and take good care of them. They're special.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sam Lee, Heidi Seip, Doug Gall, and are we going to have Alfonso too?
Yeah.
Alfonso Bunnell. And then our next group will be from Portland Public Schools. We'll have Carol Smith, Bobby Regan, and Cowan Sullivan. Yes, and nothing like a child to make us all cry.
Members of the committee, co-chairs, Senator Monroe, Representative Comp. My name is Sam Lee. I'm a member of the Winston-Dillard School Board, as well as on the Board of Directors for the Oregon School Board Association. I'd just like to thank you for allowing me to give you a little insight into what these different funding levels look like in our rural district. Winston-Dillard School District has 1,419 students, and with the loss of the timber industry, our local economy is crippled. So let's start at the top, $7.85 billion. At this level, we basically keep our heads above water. We can handle our roll-up costs, hold class sizes where they are at this time, possibly patch a roof, do a few capital projects that we need to get done. Our facilities are aging, like a lot of rural schools. And full-day kindergarten happens without pinching the rest of the district. Then we hit $7.5 billion. Well, this is where we start cutting. Class sizes would increase. Roll-up costs could be met with the help of our bargaining units. They've helped out before. But our students and staff feel the tightening around the district, and we are not able to do the basic necessary capital projects at this level. So at $7.235 billion, we need to let some water out of the pool because we are drowning. It's time to cut. And here are some basic choices. We can cut 6 school days. We're already at the bottom quintile for the nation for instructional hours, so a few more, what the heck. We can cut 7 full-time instructional assistants. What happens there is that leaves students that are just on the cusp that need that little extra attention. They drop off to failing. We can cut 4 teachers, which in our small district, that basically means that our class size for primary school classes go up above 30, and I mean solidly above 30. Or we can cut those at the high school level, which means we remove electives. 4 teachers gone would pretty well take care of band, music, shop, and all but 1 class of foreign language. What these numbers don't show you is the wear and tear on staff. Principals become bookkeepers running their schools on shoestrings, not helping teachers be the great people they can be, the great instructors they can be. Our students feel it because there aren't the people there helping that used to be able to take the time to help. Our instructional people, our teachers, are spending every moment they can trying to catch up with Common Core, the new state and federal mandates, and keep everything above. Thank you. Please fund us at $7.85 billion.
Thank you. Heidi, you next?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Representative Comp, members of the committee. Good morning. I'm Heidi Sipes, superintendent of the Umatilla School District. I'm honored to serve the community with what I believe is the greatest untapped potential in Oregon. My students make up the poorest student population in the state, but I assure you they are also the brightest, most motivated, and willing to learn. Education is not just important to my students, it is the only way for us to guarantee that their future is not like their present. Today, I have brought 2 wonderful people with you, and I'm going to give a lot of my time to them, if that's possible. So we have Alfonso Bernal, who began his school experience just as the budget cuts hit our school district. So he began as a kindergartner right after we had cut 18.4 FTE, we'd reduced purchases to the bare minimum, we deferred curriculum adoption, and we'd eliminated 6 sports. We have not yet added back what was lost, and instead we've been struggling just to keep our district solvent over the past few years. If the budget passes at 7.235, we face an additional $500,000 in cuts, and I honestly can't even wrap my brain around how to start with that process. I've also brought with you today Mr. Doug Gall, who's a tremendous 5th grade teacher who came to Oregon in 2008. Which you can imagine was ill-timed. However, he has made it work, and so I turn this over to both of them, please.
Thank you.
Good morning. I came to Umatilla in 2008 after 31 years in public education in Washington State, 25 as an administrator, and I'd always known I wanted to finish my career in the classroom, so Umatilla gave me that chance, and I had two great years in fourth grade, and the budget crisis hit, and I was riffed, along with some really gifted young teachers. So I was able to land a couple of administrative jobs, but that's not why I came to Oregon. So waited for my turn, and I got back to a fifth grade classroom last year, which I'm doing again this year. I have 32 kids in my room. Next year I'll probably have 34 or 35. I can manage that. I can't do as much as I would like to do, and my colleagues, who are just terrific at McNary Heights, they manage it too and do just a great job. We could do so much more. So we're hoping that we can get some consistent and adequate funding. Those of us in the trenches looking to you and understanding the just tremendous challenges you face. So we're hoping you'll be able to keep us in mind as you go through your process and help us work with and for the future, one face of which happens to be sitting next to me.
That's your cue, Alfonso.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to visit with you today. I'm Alfonso Bernal. I'm a fifth grader at McNary Heights Elementary School. I love my school and I love my town. I'm proud to be from Umatilla, but I'm also sad to know that my experience in Umatilla is much different from the experience of my sisters who've graduated. When my sisters were in elementary school, they got to go to music class. I've never even had a music teacher. When my sister Priscilla was a fifth grader, she had 24 students in her class, and I have 33 students in mine, and we're not the largest classroom. When my sisters were in fifth grade, they were doing the math I did in third grade. They didn't do the math I'm doing now until eighth grade. When my sisters were in elementary school, they had art supplies, paper, and pencils. Now we have to hope that Walmart donates the unsold school supplies to our school because many of our families can't afford to buy them for us, and the school doesn't have them. When my sisters headed off to middle school, they got to look forward to sixth grade track and field and school activities. I won't get to run track or be involved in clubs. When my sisters went to middle school, they got to have teachers just for the sixth graders so they can be in one class for much of the day and learn to move into middle school slowly. Next year, my teachers will teach 6th through 8th grade, and I'll be moving in the hallways with the older kids right away. When my sisters went to high school, they got to choose from all kinds of different electives and classes. I don't know what electives will be left there for me. When my sister was the first person in our family to graduate high school, she had lots of people to help her who will help me. When my sister got sick in high school, there was a nurse to help her come back to school safely. If I get sick, who will help take care of me? When my sisters went to high school, we were very proud of them because they were the first people in my family to earn college credits. And they did it right at the high school. Will there be college in my future? When my sisters are very successful. They are doing well in their adult lives, and I'm really proud of them. I want to be an engineer. I only get one chance at my education, one chance to be a kid, and one chance to be a student. This is my chance. I need more help to become who I want to be in life. I need more teachers. I need more activities. I need more from my school. I promise you I'll give more when I'm an adult. I'll become a person who will change this world for good. I am smart. I work hard. I give back to my town, and I want to make this world a better place. But first, I need to finish school. I know other people helped you become where you are today. Can you please help me become who I want to be tomorrow? Thank you.
Thank you.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Co-Chair Monroe, do you have a comment for this young man?
I'll hire him.
Good job, Alfonso.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. And I hope your sisters help you pick out that shirt. It's awesome. Okay. Carol Smith, Bobby Reagan, and Gwen Sullivan. And then...
let's go.
Oh, okay. And then on deck, we'll have Dana Pepper, Megan Gort, and Karina Permita.
Co-chairs Kump and Monroe, members of the committee. I'm Bobby Regan, and I'm the stage setter for this panel with Portland Public Superintendent Carol Smith and Portland Association of Teachers President Gwen Sullivan. I was elected to the Portland School Board in 2003, the year after Portland Public Schools was lampooned in the National Doonesbury comic strip, because we were going to cut 25 days from the school calendar. Since then, Portland Public Schools has held things together mostly due to the generosity of our local taxpayers. They approved a Multnomah County income tax that provided $50 million for each of the next 3 years to help keep our doors open and maintain class sizes. Over the next decade, we faced tens of millions of dollars in cuts annually due to a downturn in the economy and a lessening investment by the state in K-12 education. But in Portland, our local taxpayers stepped up again, passing a local teachers levy in 2006, 2011, and again last year. Even so, we still were forced to decimate central office supports to our schools and eliminate many electives and enrichments that give kids a reason to wake up every morning and want to go to school. Compared to many districts, we've actually been lucky. Last year was the first year since I've been on the board that we actually had a bit of an investment budget, thanks to the legislature stepping up with a $1 billion increase in the K-12 budget. With this, we were able to increase instructional time by adding back 2 days of school. We added 200 teaching positions, a half-time counselor in every school, and a career coordinator in each of our high schools. So today I ask you to be visionary and to work toward an investment budget again for our kids rather than a cuts budget or a hold steady budget. When Portland Public Schools and school districts across Oregon have the opportunity to make targeted and intentional investments in our kids, magic happens. You will see an accelerated gain in student achievement, a closing of the student achievement gap, and high school graduation rates that we in Oregon can be proud of.
Thank you, Bobby.
Co-chairs Kump and Monroe and members of the committee, I'm Carol Smith, superintendent for Portland Public Schools, and I'm in my 8th year as superintendent, and I will say, as Director Regan just referenced, this was the first year we had a no-cuts budget, and we were actually able to invest in our schools, and it was a really different start to the school year, not having taken apart school teams and taken apart strategies that we know are working for kids as we started the school year. We now have kids that every single year of their K-12 experience has been about losing teachers and having their school staff dismantled. So it was really exciting to start school this year. As you're aware, the $7.5 billion for K-12 represents the ability to sustain our current service levels and implement full day K without damaging services to students at other grade levels. The $7.875 billion represents an actual investment budget, which, given the state of our economy, we were really excited to think this is even a possibility that we could turn the corner and start actually investing in education in Oregon. For PPS, the currently proposed $7.235 billion budget means that we will receive more than $120 less per ADMW in our district. That's a significant cut from our current service levels. It also means we'll be $13 million short of what it would take for us to implement full day K. And PPS already provides full day K that's funded by Title I and by tuition. We'll lose the tuition revenue as we go to implementing full day K that we can get full weighting from the state. However, we'll be $13 million short of actually being able to provide it, so it'll come from other grade levels. As Director Regan just said, Portland's different in that we have local option, which means we're able to do investment, but it's voter-directed investment. It's not intended to do a backfill for an inadequate amount of state funding. So it puts us in a little bit of a different position. Finally, I would just say we're not looking for speed with which you move this investment in education. We're looking for an investment budget in education, and at the very least, an adequate budget, not that we're going into this next biennium with cuts to education. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent.
How do you do? I'm Gwen Sullivan. I'm also a parent in Portland Public Schools, a teacher, and I am the president of Portland Association of Teachers that represents about 4,000 teachers in Portland. So after years of cuts, I want to say thank you for beginning to start investing in our schools and looking at the budget moving forward, a minimum of 7.5 without the 7.5 as a minimum, it begins to erase some of the investment that we just started. And as many of you have heard, that we are have the second highest class sizes in the country, and a budget of 7.5 does nothing to address that, but it doesn't make it worse. I think with our last budget, we were beginning to make some small improvements for many of our neediest kids. And I'm talking predominantly our kids in poverty. So if I could describe a couple of things that we've begun to do, it's not full implementation, but we've started to do some things. So I want to describe in Portland what that means and what it means in the classroom. So we have some of our high school teachers and support staff have finally started to look at absenteeism. And we know that if kids aren't in school, then they aren't learning. So when we have a teacher that calls a student or knocks on their door to see where they are, and they find out that they're home taking care of their younger sibling because somebody needs to be there for their baby sister, because of some of the increases, we've been able to start to target some of the wraparound services that our kids really need, not just for the kid that's not at school, but for the other one that needs childcare. And so this begins to start to address some of those issues that come out of our kids in poverty, and we can get that kid that is watching their older or their younger sibling, we can get them into school where they should be learning. In Portland, a 7.5 budget will do, like I say, nothing about our class sizes, but it won't make it worse. A 7.5 at a minimum won't bring more librarians into all of our schools, but it won't make it worse at a 7.5. At least it won't be taken away. At 7.5 in Portland, it doesn't do anything but hold steady on a class size. And I think about some of our teachers in their first grade teachers who have 34 kids in their class, and they're trying to get all of those kids to learn how to read. And by the end of that year, the teachers feel so frustrated because they know they want to work with all of those kids and address their needs. It still doesn't do, 7.5 doesn't do anything to address that large class size to get them to be able to read by the end of third grade, or at least to start to. So I think the thing that's really important is that our kids do deserve more, and the investment that you put in now, it pays for itself in the future. So please look at an investment budget, because I think our schools and our students deserve it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for coming this morning.
Yeah.
And all of you work so hard, and it's not an easy job, yeah. And I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And yours isn't easy either, so thank you.
Exactly.
That's for sure.
Okay, for our panel that's coming up is Dana Hepper, Megan Gorky, and Karina, and Karina, you can tell us your last name when you get here. And then on deck, we will have Colt Gill, Peter Bauer, and Tribal Chief Wren. And Steve
Boynton.
Boynton, if you're here in the room and don't have to come too far, come on up, please. That's the next round, that's right. Yeah. Time's moving very fast. But Dana, do you want to start?
Good morning, Chair Comp, members of the committee. Thanks so much for the opportunity to testify. My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Director of Policy and Program at the Children's Institute. And I won't repeat the research supporting investments in early childhood as both good for kids and cost-effective. If I haven't harangued you on that already, I'm sure I'll be in your office soon. But I will say, despite all the mounting evidence pointing to early childhood as a cost-effective investment, Oregon spends 14 cents on early learning for every dollar we spend on K-12 learning. We won't make meaningful progress for children by third grade without spending more on early learning. And Children's Institute is advocating for three specific investments. First, a $10 million increase in Healthy Families Oregon, which is an effective and voluntary home visiting program for families with children age 0 to 3. Only 15% of low-income families have access to the service now, and yet investments save $2 to $5 down the road when we make them for every dollar invested. Second, a $30 million investment in high-quality preschool. 3 out of 4 low-income children don't have access to high-quality preschool because we don't have spots for them in the state. That's 32,000 3- and 4-year-olds right now. Of the $30 million we support, 1/3 of those dollars going directly to Oregon Head Start pre-kindergarten, and 2/3 to be available for a mix of approaches that could include more Head Start slots, but also slots in other types of settings that meet high-quality standards. And on this issue, you're going to hear from Megan Grecki, who's sitting next to me, Karina Armanta. Both of them are parents of preschool-age children. You'll also hear from Head Start Association president and 3 Head Start parents about the impact of high-quality preschool on children's lives.
Thank you, Dana.
The third is a $5 million investment in the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund, which is the only current investment that connects early childhood with elementary school, and it's paying for proven approaches of family engagement of young children on how to prepare their kids for school success, shared professional development between K-3 educators and early childhood educators, and transition programs for incoming kindergartners to make sure they enter the kindergarten door ready to be successful. And I think with that, I will turn it over to Megan.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is
Welcome.
Megan Grecki. Chair's comp and committee. Sorry.
You're
My
fine.
Name is Megan Grecki. I am a parent of 2 kids, a 7-year-old in 2nd grade and a 3-year-old who has just started a part-time preschool. I've had a lot of issues trying to get my daughter into preschool. My son wasn't able to go to preschool. My daughter, we had to jump through quite a bit of hoops. She doesn't qualify to go to Earl Boyle's preschool up in Portland, Southeast Portland, in the David Douglas School District, because we are 2 feet out of the Earl Boyle's district. We had to fill out a bunch of paperwork. I called 40 different preschools, and because of different issues, she didn't qualify. She has now started preschool. She goes twice a week. Since she has started preschool, she has made new friends, especially her best friend, who her name is Ruby, and she has Down syndrome. And on Ruby's first day, my daughter was the only one that played with her. My daughter has come out of her shell since she started preschool. Even though she only goes 5.5 hours a week, my daughter has, her name is Madeline, but we call her Minnie. She has just grown so much. She was already smart, but now, you know, she's writing letters and numbers. She knows all of her colors. She knows half of her alphabet, and she's only been going 3 months, and that's twice a week. But to get her into that was a lot of hard work. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm very nervous, so I might repeat myself.
That's all right. Sometimes it doesn't hurt us to hear things twice.
Okay, good.
Just breathe. Just tell us about Minnie.
Yeah, she's really, really come a long way. She's learning so much in preschool that I would not be able to do for her at home. The relationships that she's coming with the kids in her class, they're all her best friends. Preschool is amazing. Like, I can't even imagine my daughter not being in preschool. I wish I could have done it for my son. I honestly believe my second grader, JR, would be more advanced in second grade if he had started in preschool. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and I'm glad Minnie's doing so well.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Comp. Good morning, Chair Comp. My name is Karina Armenta. I'm sorry for my English. It's not 100%, but I try to explain my feelings. I have a daughter. She go to the preschool 2 years ago. Now she's in the kindergarten. And I have a really good experience for have a child in the preschool. And I have an old child, 10 years old. He doesn't have any opportunity to go to the Head Start or preschool. I don't know why he never called me for send my kids to the school. But with my daughter, have a big opportunity at the Air Boys Elementary School. And for me, it's open the big door in my home. Because, you know, now the kids play a lot of Twitch TV and everything in the machines, and everything is technology, everything is stay in the room, don't play outside, don't play with the kids. Now I see that different in both kids. One don't go to the preschool, and one go to the preschool. And for both, have a really, really, really good experience about the school, because the teachers, for now, my daughter at the kindergarten, she started to kindergarten, and 100% more accurate for starting to kindergarten. Because if you compare one kid starting to kindergarten and don't have a preschool, know a lot of things, but not really understand what is the means. Colors, numbers, conversation, rules, stay with another kids, with adults and everything. But the most important is my teachers, and for my daughter and for my son, have the big role model. It's a big role model at the school, the best in the group and the best in another group. For both teachers, tell me, your kid's so amazing. It's not my only work, it's the work in the school too. And I know we have a big opportunity for have my child in the preschool, and she's starting to the next year, so I'm waiting for her, and she's already prepared. Please, please, think about it. A lot of kids have opportunity for hands, the whole world in the hands to early age. You don't have to start into the kindergarten for starting to learn. Thank you so much, and I hope you guys can help us.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you for bringing your beautiful daughter.
Thank you so much.
This is Daniela.
Daniela.
And I hear great things about Earl Boyles. One of these days, I'm going to get there.
Earl Boyles
is in my district.
We have a United group for Ed Boyles.
Senator Canope.
We'll
follow up with Colt and Peter and Steve.
Yeah, Ren.
And with Ryan. Yes, our tribal chair.
Thank you, Chair Comp and members of the committee.
And just that you know, Senator, we're only giving you 3 minutes.
I will try to take less than that.
Okay.
Committee members, my name is Tim Canope, State Senator, Senate District 27, represents Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. I wanted to come and advocate for an amendment that I have to this budget for K-12, which is $8 billion.
I recognize that's a lot of money. I recognize that's more than the co-chairs have recommended or the governor. However, the feedback from my district is that that's a cuts budget at the co-chairs level, and significantly so. And so I just wanted to read you a couple of comments from some emails I've been getting from some teachers. Please stop the madness of underfunding schools in our state. We sucked it up in 2008 when the economy tanked. We fell on our sword to try to maintain the system for those awful years. Another one, I'm writing to urge support for state school fund for K through 12 of $7.5 billion or more. If the budget falls below this number, my district, which is Redmond, will be forced to cut days and staff members as well as increase class sizes. Here's another one. In Oregon, we need to keep up with the rest of the country. We cannot continue to shortchange our children by not investing in their education. A $7.25 billion budget would mean more days cut, higher class sizes, and additional programs cut. And it just kind of the list goes on. So, colleagues, when I was majority leader in 2003, we funded education at nearly 45% of general fund and lottery, which was the equivalent today of over $8 billion. And so my encouragement is let's try to get as close to $8 billion as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Monroe, did you have a question?
Oh, sure. Why not?
Well, since the good senator's been around the block a few times.
I've been around a little bit.
Not you, him.
Yeah, both of us.
You guys too.
Tim, I'd absolutely like to get closer to $8 billion, but you know that we spend money on three things in this state: public safety, human resources, and education. To increase the K-12 budget, we would have to cut in one of those areas or raise additional revenue by increasing taxes or vote to keep the kicker, which is about $350 million. Do you advocate any of those revenue choices?
Madam Chair and Senator Monroe, thank you for that. However, those aren't the only three choices. So, and I don't particularly advocate for those, although I would suggest that we've added thousands of employees to state government over the last decade, and we all say we want to prioritize education. So either we mean it or we don't. And so would that mean cutting somewhere else? I think that's a possibility. But what I've been advocating for the last 2 years since I came back to the legislature is focusing on sustainable revenue, which is creating jobs. And we have the opportunity to do that through a myriad of bills. So my focus this session has been on, and last session, trying to create or help small business create more private sector jobs, because every job that we create, basically the revenue that comes in from those taxes, about 45% of it should go to K through 12. And that should be our goal, is focusing on creating jobs. We could keep the kicker, Senator, but the problem with that is that's not a sustainable source of revenue.
No.
So, you know, I would advocate trying to do something that's more sustainable. And so that's either limiting the size and growth of government and prioritizing education, or focusing on private sector job creation.
Thank you, Senator. And Senator Thompson, and you guys better be brief, because now I'm going to, you know, get the hook.
No, I'll be brief. Sarah Knoll, in my experience looking back at how we used to fund education, I've seen numbers as high as 43%. What was the year that you said that, and the higher levels of the percentage of the budget?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Thompson. I think the highest we ever got was about 44.9% of general fund and lottery, which is over $8 billion if you apply that same percentage to today's budget. And I can just say that when I was the majority leader, the Democratic minority said that that was not enough. And so I'm saying that it would be enough. So let's try to get there.
And follow up, and where I've heard we're about 36%. We went as low as 32.
I think we're 37.
Kind of back to 36 or 37.
37.
I think we're 39.1. I think is about where they were coming in, somewhere in that neighborhood. I could be wrong.
So, one more last follow up. Would the $8 billion get us back to about 43, 44%?
That would get us to 43.3%.
So it's just about making priorities.
It is.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, more?
No, not for you, but you may be interested in this.
Well, okay, hurry
to
up.
To follow along with my theme of questions
I'm
for the week.
I'm regretting this.
Mr. Wilson, would the $8 billion come out of the $60
million? Yes.
No comment.
Senator, thank you for coming and sharing. I appreciate it. Okay.
Rep Huffman, if you could do that, that would be amazing.
If you guys find that pot of gold under that, leprechaun this year. So, Colt Gill, Peter Bauer, Rana, I'm sorry, Chief, I'm really messing up your name, and then Steve Boynton. And on deck, I forgot we have on deck. Michael, and Dan Goldman, and Mark Thielman. Okay, Colt, get me started because I can pronounce your name.
Okay, co-chairs Comp and Monroe and members of the committee, thanks for hearing us today. My name is Colt Gill. I'm superintendent at Bethel School District in Eugene. I'm also this year the president of COSA, and I currently serve as the chair of the Quality Education Commission. Oregon once had a reputation as a leader in education in our country, a reputation that I think today is all but forgotten. We now share and live the embarrassment of being near the bottom of nearly every yardstick measure there is in education. Our previous presenters shared 49th in graduation rates, 49th in class size, instructional hours that fall far short of what other students are getting in this country. And why? Craig pointed out earlier, and our previous speaker just did, we used to fund at 45% of our state budget, and now we're funding at 39%. After years of dramatic cuts that have impacted students, and now coming into a year where we're no longer in a recession, in a year where we're supposed to be implementing full-day kindergarten, the co-chair's K-12 budget of $7.235 billion delivers less per student funding than the current year. And I passed around a document similar to Craig's that focused on metro area schools. This one focuses on Lane County schools that range in size from about 200 students up to over 16,000 students, and every one of them are hit the same way. The loss of millions of dollars in revenue, along with increased costs of the addition of full-day kindergarten, means that we're facing more lost school days, even higher class sizes, further reduction of meaningful programs like CTE, and more cash-strapped districts will be facing labor strife, creating even greater risks for our students. Just to maintain this fragile stability that we're living in right now, we need $7.5 billion, As a member of the Quality Education Commission, I'll also share this. I know many of us now think of the QEM as some kind of unreachable number, some kind of educational nirvana that can never be attained. Well, I'm here to tell you that that number is no longer anything special. In fact, it's just average. That number is what we need to get to the national averages in instructional time and class size. That matches the quality ed model. That's how far Oregon has fallen under our watch. I think that we owe our kids more. I think we owe the future of our state more. We would expect more of our kids, and I think we ought to deliver that in return. To create just a 10-year pathway to get to that, we need to get to that $7.875 billion. I think the one area where our state still excels is for setting high goals for our kids. We believe we can create great outcomes for our children in our state. We just don't invest in our goals or our children. In Oregon, we have our 40-40-20 goal that's set for the class of 2025. These kids are 7 and 8 years old now in second grade. I asked them in kindergarten what they wanted to be. They answered firefighters, doctors, computer programmers, monster truck drivers, and teachers. They have dreams, and we as a state said that we would deliver on those dreams, and we haven't. This class of 2025 has experienced probably the worst educational experience of any class in Oregon.
We need to, your right. last sentence.
Okay, so they have very short school years. They have classes that they've experienced of 30 to 35 their entire time in our schools. And I think that saying that we need to deliver this 7.5 just to maintain this broken system that we're currently in, and we need to get to 7.875 to head down a path to reach average.
Thank you.
So I'm hoping you'll help.
Thank you.
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Peter Bauer, and I was invited to speak before you today by the Oregon Education Association. I'm here to represent the students and parents and teachers of the Bethel School District where I work and live. This is my eighth year teaching at Cascade Middle School in Eugene, Oregon. I'm a lifelong citizen of Oregon and was in first grade when Measure 5 passed in the early 90s. When this anti-education initiative passed, it changed funding for education in a way that has eroded an entire generation's right to quality public education. As a student, I watched wave after wave of cut, and for my career as a teacher, I've seen more of the same. Today, if we wanted to restore pre-Measure 5 levels of funding for education in Oregon, we would need to add an additional $2 billion to the proposed budget. Sadly, we're nowhere near that level of funding today. With roll-up costs and the implementation of full-day kindergarten not fully funded by the proposed budget, we're once again looking at a year with more cuts. This budget does not inspire us to dream about what education could be. This budget has those who support education fighting to remember what education in Oregon used to be. This year, my largest class of the day has 36 sixth graders. That's 36 living, breathing, moving 11 and 12-year-old learners. And when I made my most recent seating chart, I realized that I now officially have more students than seats. So each day, Savannah patiently waits in the back of the class to see who's absent before she gets to take her seat. In the extended resource room across the hall from my classroom, I've seen the number of students balloon over the past 3 years from 9 students to 22, each with their own unique set of strengths, challenges, and individual IEPs. My question to you is, what message do these examples send to our students and their families about the priority of education in Oregon? Is it safe to say that Oregon values having the lowest corporate tax rate in the nation more than it values adequately funding education? Would you agree there's a direct connection between the lowest corporate tax rates and the second largest class size in America? As teachers, our working conditions are unprofessional and our compensation is substandard. Keeping and retaining high-quality teachers has a direct impact on student learning in the classroom. When the stability of this career path is called into question every 2 years because of cuts like the one proposed in this budget, it begs the question, what is Oregon doing to support career-oriented educators? Our working conditions are our students' learning conditions, and we can do better. The issue we're dealing with today is not simply about funding, it's about priority. It's about generational equity, ensuring that the students in the classrooms today are given the same opportunities you were giving as students. So let's demonstrate the value we have in today's generation of students by investing in the future of Oregon, by investing $7.87 billion in classrooms today.
Thank you
very much.
Chief, welcome.
Thank you. My name's Ren Lino. Madam Chair and committee members.
And Ren, those microphones are real sensitive.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Set back. Okay.
Yeah. There you go.
It's kind of odd sitting here as opposed to up there where I sit most of the time.
I'm always surprised I'm sitting on this side, too.
My name is Ren Lino. I am the tribal chairman at the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, representing approximately 5,200 and some tribal members, the majority of them living in Oregon. I want to take opportunity to thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today. We are here today, and I want to ask that you please continue to prioritize education and to make sure that it is adequately funded. We are here today to advocate for two specific items with the budget that we know will be a positive for both Oregon's 9 sovereign tribal governments and the state. First, another full-time position to work with the Oregon education specialists, and second, to fund the tribal attendance pilot project. I'd just like to say we are very proud that we have our tribal member, April Campbell, who is that Indian Ed specialist, so we are very close to education in the state, and we know the needs that she needs to do her job for all 9 tribes, not just for Grand Ronde. And, of course, the attendance policy project came out of the conditions of Oregon's tribal studies that was done by Spirit Mountain Community Fund, which I'm also a board member to that. And it was a great study figuring out the needs of our Indian children, and attendance, of course, is one of the biggest issues for us. It was identified that it's not only on the school, but also on the parents to try and cure that. You can't learn if you're not in school. So them are two of the projects that we are really here to support. I'd also like to say, I'd like to acknowledge your work that you have to do, obviously, understanding budgets. I am a councilman of 20 years at our tribe, so working with the education budget, seeing ours grow. Also, I'd like to acknowledge the ladies who are here with the children. I have a special needs. I have 8 grandchildren from the first grade to a freshman at Oregon State. So I have a special needs grandchild who deals with, he has seizures on a daily basis, so you can only imagine how difficult it is to try and learn and have those seizures and deal with them. But when you're in a rural area, you've got classrooms of 30, 40 kids. How can you really step out and help those kids? So I'd like to acknowledge those. And I'd also like to say, and this many of the tribes, and I don't speak for any other tribe in Grand Ronde, but when we budget, we look, and especially for education for our children, we always use the 7-generation theory. It's not just where you're at today, but where do you want to go? And where is your philosophy there? So I'd just like to thank you for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. My name is Steve Boynton. I'm the superintendent of schools for Lincoln County. We have about 6,000 students, and we represent the communities of Lincoln City, Newport, Siletz, Eddyville, Toledo, and Waldport. So I am here today to ask you to consider your state school fund in your budget process, and to let you know about the impacts that the current proposal has on the schools of our county. We have just completed our preliminary budget process, and we are going to our community meetings beginning actually this afternoon to discuss current budget positions. Under the co-chair's proposal, with current cutouts and allocations, the effect on Lincoln County School District is that we will be cutting 5 days. We will be removing 8 teachers from the classrooms. We will be seeing class sizes average in the mid-30s, and we will be eliminating 6 different educational programs. So I think it's very important for you to understand what the impacts of the decisions you're making is going to be. At the 7.5 level, it doesn't quite make Lincoln County stable. We will still be put in a position to reorganize, although I think the effects can be mitigated somewhat. We don't actually see stable funding in Lincoln County under current allocations and cutouts until about 7.7. So to get to 7.8, as you've heard several times today, would be ideal for our county and the students of our schools. So I ask you please to carefully consider what the impacts are. I know it's a very difficult decision, and you know, it's taking from one to fix another, but at some point in time, the state of Oregon is going to have to make a decision about what it's going to invest in, and if it's going to invest in the future and creating meaningful workers to help build our economy, or whether we're going to continue to invest in social programs. So I know it's a very difficult decision for you to make, and I don't envy that position. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we have our next panel coming up. Members, I'm going to ask if you can't stay a couple of minutes longer. We missed a couple of teachers that came down today, and so we have this panel and just a few more.
I'm going to stay for this panel.
Thank you. And so we have Michael and Dan and Mark, right? And then just we have Donna, who's came a whole 100 miles, and
Bob Moore.
Bob Moore.
From Bend.
And from Bend.
And then you have the two teachers.
And then the two teachers are Raina Wagner and Jennifer Gillett, and my apologies for not noticing that sooner. And if you could keep your testimony to 2.5 to 2 minutes, that would really help all of us.
Uh-oh.
All right, I'll go first. My name is Michael Weekly. I work with the Pride Project, which is in Washington County. We work with gay and lesbian youth. We've been funded for over 10 years, very mildly. I just want to say thank you. 27 youth that we've served over the last 6 months have reported that they did not want to commit suicide, that they wanted to continue in school. If you've been around Washington County, it's not the most accepting for LGBTQ youth in the school system. So our whole goal is to continue that, and we really appreciate you investing into the future of our young people, and thank you.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the extra minutes there.
No, that doesn't work that way.
All right.
So smooth.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about Senate Bill 214 and the 3-3 Literacy Initiative, and also implore to you to raise the proposed K-12 funding level to way beyond the $7.235 billion funding that's proposed. I'm Dan Goldman, and I'm currently in my second year as the superintendent of the Hood River County School District over here with Senator Thompson. Before coming to Hood River, I was the director of curriculum and instruction for the Tigard-Tualatin School District, where our students outperformed students throughout the state on every state assessment at every grade level, and where the National Center on Educational Outcomes named Tigard-Tualatin one of the 10 most effective school districts in the nation in terms of student literacy and other academic outcomes. Bluntly, the research is clear about the importance of getting students to read by the end of their primary school years and the resource drain on education, human services, and public safety budgets that occurs when youngsters miss the important milestone of third grade reading proficiency. With human services and public safety budgets increasing at a much greater clip than the state education budgets over the last 12 years, and with strategies for increasing state revenue highly unlikely in the short term, there is no more important investment than in early literacy for the state of Oregon, absolutely none. The research is also clear about what works in literacy development. I applaud the 3-3 reading initiative because it's in line with the research and what we know works right here in Oregon in school districts like Tigard-Tualatin, like Bethel, David Douglas, McMinnville, and others. Last year, only 66% of Oregon third graders were proficient readers on the state assessment. This means 34% of our state's young students require significant intervention and investment. A huge portion of K-12 budgets are spent intervening with struggling readers because we know a student just cannot make it in this world if they're not literate. These are funds not spent on CTE, not spent on STEM, not spent on IB or AP courses, or any other number of innovations that our community members and post-secondary institutions and Oregon employers expect from us. It's a huge resource drain, and if we don't do something radically different, we can expect the same outcomes over and over again. We must invest in the strategies that work and stop believing that all Oregon's youth will suddenly learn how to read by the end of third grade without significant investment. The elements in the 3-3 reading initiative as written in SB 214 are research-based and have proven to work and must be funded.
And can I ask you to wrap up?
You can. I didn't even get to my state funding pitch here, but all I can say is I just listened to Alfonso from Umatilla, and I mean, he framed it perfectly. But we have gotten in our educations, me, members of the committee, our kids are just not getting right now. And we cannot expect to change the outcomes of Oregonians and Oregonians' future if we don't invest in kids. Pure and simple. 7.5 is still a cut budget in Hood River, but we can make it probably with that number, but we need more significant investment.
Thank you. Thank you. And Senator Thompson, you can leave.
Superintendent Goldman has a board member on the back row nodding in agreement, an infamous guy named Representative Johnson, so just thought I'd point that out.
That's good, because he's my boss.
Okay, I'm Mark Thielman, superintendent from ALSEI. We're a very small school district. We neighbor Lincoln County, so I know Steve. Rather than repeat a whole bunch of stuff you've already heard, because I have nothing but bad news to share in terms of what the co-chair's budget will do to us, basically 1.5 teachers. And now, granted, we're smaller, so our class size will go up to about 25, which would be a record for our small school. I come from a timber community that's obviously been decimated in the last 30 years based on all kinds of changes and stuff. So I wanted to spend a couple of minutes telling you what folks in my community see. They knew it was serious when I was coming up here because I told them I had to wear my suit. Okay? So these are folks that work hard for a living, and they don't wear suits every day. So what they see is they saw a governor's budget come out that had a lot of carve-out money for outcome-based initiatives. strategic initiatives. Then they saw a co-chair's budget that threw a little more money back in and said, well, maybe not so much. And then they see a bunch of news releases that say, well, we can't deprioritize safety and we can't deprioritize social services and we can't but we're going to deprioritize education. That's what they see. We're the largest employer in our community is our school. Fortunately, our enrollment is increasing, so I'm going to get a whole $50,000 more in the next biennium, or actually in the next year, so $100,000 in the next biennium. Good for me. I need between $250,000 and $300,000 a year just to keep up with increased costs. So you can imagine the concern that's weighted on our community. In 2008, I was told economic times are bad, so there's no money. In 2015, I'm told economic times are good, and there's still no money. That's what we see. I do appreciate Senator Knope coming in at $8 billion, which tells me that the number must be between 7.2 and 8 billion, because I'm assuming you guys know stuff that we don't. Is that correct?
No.
No. Amen to that. However, I've worked with a lot of you individually in past sessions, and in my opinion, without being too boasting, I think you represent the best as this committee in terms of what you have the power to recommend and what you have the power to do in terms of really working through very tough issues. There are plans out there that talk about 7.5 plus some initiatives that would generate outcomes, specifically what my colleague talked about, without mandating specific statewide programs that allows districts to choose from a menu of items based on their individual circumstance.
And please, I'm going to ask you for your final.
So please don't compare me. You can't compare me to Portland Public. But we all have issues and needs for innovation. So please chat amongst yourselves about those initiatives. They're very well done and they're very good. Thank you.
And we'll put out a press release that you look good in your suit.
Well, thank you.
There you go. Thank you. Okay, folks. Doug, help me.
Okay, Bob Moore, Donna Schnichter, if I got it right. And if time, Rena Wagner and Jennifer Gilbert, these will be the last, unfortunately. If you come back tomorrow, please, we'll have you indicate that you were here today and we'll cross-check the lists, and you'll be on before anyone else. But we still have, I hate to say, multiple pages here of folks that did not get on today.
So please go ahead.
My name is Chair Kopp, members of the committee. My name is Donna Schnitger, and I'm the Oregon Head Start Association president and also the director of early childhood programs in Harney County for Harney ESD. And I'm coming here today to tell you that Head Start, as you probably already know, is the provider of services to children who are 100% of poverty or below. We also work with the families. What we are supporting is the governor's recommended budget to maintain the current funding levels for Oregon Head Start pre-kindergarten program. And we also support the increased investment of $30 million that is presented by the Children's Institute in their bill. We also know that one-third of the money that will be allocated under this bill would go to the base funding of Oregon pre-kindergarten program that would help us achieve our 100% that we're shooting for eventually down the road. What this does is it will give us the ability to serve two-thirds of the children who are on waiting lists currently. So some statistics, 12,656 children are enrolled in Head Start and Oregon pre-kindergarten programs currently in Oregon. 62% of the children eligible for Head Start are being currently served. There are 1,873 children on program waiting lists, and with this additional $10 million, we would be able to pay for 1,200 eligible children on those waiting lists to be enrolled in Head Start. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Representative Comp, members of the committee, my name is Bob Moore. I'm the past board chair and current board member for the High Desert Educational Service District in Bend. I'm here today to ask your committee to increase funding for early intervention, early childhood special education programs 15%, which would represent a $25 million increase over current service levels for the biennium. I've sat on our board for somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 years, and I can't actually remember a time during that 10 years that we haven't talked about early intervention either being flat funded or lack of current funding levels. We've backfilled out of our general budget and out of reserves to try to make that program whole and continue to see it struggle over years and years. We've been instructed when our contract is short of the service levels that we require to reduce staff, reduce days, and reduce student contact. And that's been a problem our board has faced for the better part of 10 years. This year, we've launched an effort to do some advocacy around increasing funding for our early intervention, early childhood special ed programs. It was great to see Lily, who was actually one of our little kids that served under our contract, and hear the words that parents talk about how important those services are. We developed a white paper that Ozzie has circulated to you. We'll also provide electronic copies to you as well that outlines this concern. We've worked with partners. We started working with Oregon school boards about this issue. Initially, we were told that, this might not be a K-12 issue. I'm here to tell you that our board members from Central Oregon believe very much that it is a K-12 issue. Looking through our white paper, you'll see that a third of our kids that receive early intervention services that are identified early don't require those services as they transition into our K-12 districts. That very much makes it a K-12 issue for our boards. We've worked with Oregon School Boards, Oregon Association of ESDs, COSA, and Oregon OEA to make sure that they're on board in supporting this effort of increased funding for earlier intervention. A year or so ago, I sat in a conference with the Oregon Association of ESD conferences, and Rob Saxon came to talk about how we ESDs can partner better with ODE. One of the presentations he made was on initiatives, and one of them, as you're aware, is the effort around making sure kids are ready at a third grade level to be reading. He presented a chart, and the bottom broke down all sorts of graphs about demographics. And the bottom two pieces of that were earlier intervention kids and ELL kids. So when we got to the end of the presentation, I was able to ask Rob, why it is that we're really looking to elevate these kids so they can read at third grade level, and why we're not funding these kids at an appropriate level if they're at the bottom of the graph. And Rob just talked a little bit and matter-of-factly said, we're failing these kids. That's kind of what our position is as well, that we're failing these kids, and we ask that this board consider a 15% increase in those service levels. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. Do we still have two teachers in the room, Raina and Jennifer?
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Senator. They're
backing up in my office.
I know. I don't know what my staff's doing. Going crazy.
I believe I missed two appointments, but it's fine.
Yes.
I'm good.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Comp and members of the committee. My name is Jen Gillette. I've been teaching for 12 years, the last 10 years, in David Douglas School District. For the past 2 years, I've had a hybrid role in David Douglas School District. I teach 6th grade language arts in the morning, and I co-manage the collaboration grant for our district in the afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning in support of funding for the Network of Quality Teaching and Learning, particularly funding for the School District Collaboration Fund. David Douglas is in year 2 of implementation of the School Collaboration Grant. In 2012 and 13, David Douglas received a $30,000 design grant from Chalkboard to begin the work on the four components and design our comprehensive blueprint for each four areas of evaluation, career pathways, professional learning, and compensation. In 2013-14, the Oregon Department of Education awarded David Douglas School District a collaboration grant to implement the work we began in our class design year. And as I mentioned, this is year 2 for that grant. The teaching standards in David Douglas's new teacher evaluation have become the language of instruction in our district. Myself and the other teachers I work with have clear targets and a clear focus on how we can improve our practice and meet the needs of our students. For example, when we discuss the needs of our students and in turn our professional learning needs, we can align them to one of the four domains of our evaluation rubric. Assessment for student learning has been a big focus for me and my students this year, which encompasses the standards around designing assessments, clear learning expectations, engaging students in learning, and using assessment in instruction. I'm better able to determine where my students are at with meeting their targets, and they are too. The evaluation outcome data has been shared so that we all have a common understanding of what our professional learning needs are and how we can work together for our students. This data supports our district's focus on deep understandings of the Common Core State Standards and assessment literacy for all educators funded by the collaboration grant. Previously, this data was not shared, nor did we have a common language of instruction. In addition, writing student learning and growth goals have helped me focus my instruction and track my students' growth. I have collaborative conversations with my colleagues regarding how we can improve our practice and better meet the needs of our students. For example, our student learning and growth goals are aligned to the Common Core State Standards, and we are continually going back to the data we collect to see where our students are at in terms of meeting the goal. The teacher leadership opportunities that have been created through these funds have empowered teachers to give their voice and how to best meet the needs of their students. We have teacher leaders who are still in the classroom and making building and district decisions about what is best for students. It takes time and space to have the conversations necessary to create lasting change. With the new demands of Common Core State Standards comes a new form of teacher leadership. In order to change culture, teacher leaders must identify student needs and be given the time and place to do something about it. One way that David Douglas has begun to do this is by implementing the Cadre of Distinguished Educators, a career pathway for teachers that supports teachers' voice.
And Jennifer, yes, can we finish?
Thank you for your time. The School District Collaboration Fund is making a difference for educators and students in Dave and Douglas. It's imperative that this program remain available to districts ready to take on this serious and significant work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Comp and members of the committee. My name is Rena Wagner, and I am a member of the Distinguished Educator Council. I have taught in the Silver Falls School District for 23 years. I began my career as a kindergarten teacher and then have since moved to special education. I have taught in our larger town schools and our rural K-8 buildings. I have taught primary students how to read and eighth graders how to do pre-algebra. Currently, I run an early intervening program in a K-3 building where we look to support students before they fall behind and need special education services. In addition, I have three children who attend Oregon Public Schools. I also appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning for the funding of the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning, particularly the funding of the School District Work Collaboration Fund. I am a member of our school district's design team, and we are in year one of implementation. We also were tasked with creating a blueprint for district improvement. As a group, we've read research, we've looked at district models, and had long, impactful discussions around teaching, learning, and improving student achievement. As a result, we have also created a teacher cadre to focus on teacher improvement, instructional improvement, and teacher evaluation. Teachers and administrators work alongside each other to observe teachers and provide meaningful and timely feedback that immediately impacts instruction. We also have formed a professional development committee, which provides in-service based on data. It monitors the effectiveness of our monthly PLC meetings and works to create professional development opportunities throughout our district that are tied to state initiatives and district and personal professional goals. Our next steps are to continue this work based on research of best practices that is data-driven and organized and implemented by and for teachers. I'm amazed at how much professional development has improved in the short time we've had this grant. We have received, teachers are highly trained in our new evaluation system, and it now is purposeful instead of just a hoop we've had to jump through. We have attended some of the best in-service training our district has ever provided, and across the district we've seen improved use of our PLC time. Most important part of this work is it involves collaboration. Teachers are a part of the decision-making process. They're involved in the process, therefore they're invested in the process. Everything, again, is based on research and data, not opinion. It feels supportive rather than punitive and removes the isolation barrier that has long existed in education. In my own program, I've seen a huge change in student achievement in the past year as we've been given time to learn new assessment systems, to analyze data, and then use that data to drive instruction. We need to make certain that teachers in our schools receive the training and supports they need. This is the most important thing we can do to meet the needs of Oregon students. Oregon needs to continue building the network to fully meet these needs. We have just begun the work. We still have a lot of work to do. Research has shown that the most influential factor in student achievement is the teacher. We need to make a strong investment in teachers in order to improve the future of our education in our state. Thank you, Chair Comp and members of the committee, for your time.
Thank you, Raina. You did a great job.
Oh, thanks. Yes, I was very nervous.
Well, it didn't show at all.
I tell you, I think Alfonso set a high bar for all of us today.
Yes,
so
he did.
Yes. And for others that were not able to testify today, we will continue tomorrow. And any other thing... Okay, so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5016 and House Bill 5017. In committee, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.